Imagine, just for a second, that for the last few years you've been on a strict international do not fly list.
Oh man, yeah, that sounds awful.
Right. It is an absolute ordeal. I mean, every single time you go to the airport, you get pulled out of line, taken into a back room, your bags are just completely unpacked.
Yeah, they check everything.
Exactly. Like every single receipt in your wallet is scrutinized and your travel companions are interrogated. And this happens every single time without fail, simply because of your last name.
Right, it's an automatic trigger.
Yeah. But now imagine waking up one morning and you getting an official letter saying you are, finally off that list. It is a massive relief. You can finally breathe.
Sure.
But getting off that list doesn't mean airport security just waves you through the metal detector with a wink.
No, definitely not.
Right. I mean, it doesn't mean they stop checking your bags. It just means they stop doing mandatory, grueling strip searches on every single person who happens to share your last name. They basically shift from a blanket ban to smart evidence-based screening.
Which, fundamentally changes the operational reality for both the passenger and the security guard. I mean, it is a massive shift from pure assumption to actual analysis.
And that operational shift is exactly what we are getting into today. We are unpacking a massive regulatory milestone, which is Pakistan's official removal from the European Union's high-risk third country list for money laundering and terrorist financing.
It's a huge deal in the compliance
Yeah, it
world.
really is. And we have a robust stack of primary sources driving this deep dive today, including FATF mutual evaluation reports, Pakistan's own 2023 national risk assessment, and the underlying EU regulatory filings.
So a lot of dense material to get through.
Yeah, exactly. But whether you work in global finance, manage international trade, or just have like an intense curiosity about how money actually moves and gets blocked around the world, this is really a masterclass in how global systems measure and manage completely invisible risks.
Because the reality of global finance is that risk never truly disappears.
Right.
It merely changes shape. So how institutions respond to a major label change like this, well, it tells us everything about the mechanics of the global economy.
Okay, let's unpack this. In March of 2023, the European Union officially delisted Pakistan from its high-risk index.
Yeah, March 2023.
Right. And this came after the FATF, the Financial Action Task Force, removed Pakistan from their increased monitoring list in October of 2022.
Right, they had a few months gap there.
Yeah. And on paper, Pakistan successfully completed two massive action plans, tackling 34 different reform items.
But I mean, if a country is officially taken off the high-risk list, doesn't that mean international banks can just, open the floodgates?
Well, you would think so, but
Because if the official warning label is gone, shouldn't a bank in Frankfurt or Paris just treat a transaction from Karachi like any other low-risk payment?
I mean, it is super tempting to view delisting as this like clean bill of health, but the mechanics of compliance dictate otherwise. What actually happened here is the removal of an automatic legal trigger.
Okay, an automatic trigger. Right. When a country is on that EU high-risk list, regulated financial institutions across the European Union are legally required to apply what's called enhanced customer due diligence, or EDD.
Which is the mandatory strip search at our metaphorical airport.
Exactly.
But what does EDD actually look like on the ground, say, for a regular bank employee?
Honestly, it looks like incredible amounts of friction. Every single transaction or business relationship linked to that listed country requires a manual override.
Oh, wow. Every single one.
Yes. A compliance officer actually has to establish the exact source of wealth. They have to gather extensive documentation on the beneficial owners, and they have to escalate even routine account openings to senior management for approval.
Wait, so even if the customer is like a highly regulated international exporter who's been banking with them for decades.
It does not matter. If they have a link to the listed country, the legal trigger fires. The bank must spend money and man hours investigating it, period.
So delisting simply removes that legal mandate. It doesn't magically declare the country free from financial crime risk. It just means the bank doesn't have to treat every single transaction as a five-alarm fire.
Right. The compliance challenge shifts to what we call recalibration. Institutions have to replace that lazy list-based treatment.
You just look at a spreadsheet and automatically block a transaction.
Exactly. They have to replace that with evidence-led assessments. You have to look at the risks that persist beneath the country label. So if a specific customer still shows elevated risk indicators, the institution is still expected to apply enhanced scrutiny.
So the burden of judgment moves from the regulator back to the bank itself.
You got it. It's on them now.
That makes the distinction between the different lists incredibly important, because to understand why this EU delisting is such a game changer for day-to-day operations, we really have to look at how it differs from the FATF list.
Yeah, they are very different beasts.
Right, because the FATF put Pakistan on their increased monitoring list, what everyone calls the gray list, back in June 2018. The FATF gray list seems kind of like your doctor looking at your blood work, warning you to watch your cholesterol and scheduling closer checkups.
That's a good way to look at it.
But the EU list, that is like your health insurance company legally mandating a strict diet and charging you double your premium if you don't document every single calorie.
Yeah, that's incredibly accurate. They are related processes, sure, and removal from the FATF list heavily influenced the EU's assessment, but they carry fundamentally different legal weight.
Okay, so break that down for us.
Well, the FATF is a global standard setter. When they place a country on the gray list, they are urging a risk-based approach. In fact, FATF actively cautions against indiscriminate de-risking.
Meaning they don't want banks just cutting everyone off.
Right. They do not want banks just severing ties with entire countries. But the European Commission's list, that is baked directly into EU law.
Which totally explains the timeline gap. If FATF took Pakistan off their gray list in October 2022, the EU took until March 2023 because, well, they were dealing with bureaucratic inertia.
Oh, absolutely. It requires a completely separate legal mechanism, specifically delegated regulation 2023-410. I mean, it takes time to draft it, pass it through the European Parliament and the Council, and actually enter it into force.
Right.
And while that clock is ticking, the real-world harm of being on that EU list just continues to compound.
Let's talk about that real-world harm, because being on a high-risk list isn't just, you know, a reputational black eye. It physically breaks the plumbing of international trade.
Mm-hmm.
How does that de-risking actually happen in practice?
So it happens primarily through correspondent banking.
Okay.
See, local banks in Pakistan need massive global banks in New York or Frankfurt to process foreign currencies. But when a country is on the EU high-risk list, those global banks look at the massive cost of performing enhanced due diligence on every single transaction flowing through that corridor.
Because of that automatic legal trigger we talked about.
Yeah, exactly. And very often, the compliance cost simply exceeds the profit margin of doing the business. So what do? The global bank just pulls the plug. They close the correspondent accounts.
Wow. And suddenly, a local manufacturer who makes textiles in Lahore can't pay their supplier in Germany.
Right.
Not because they're doing anything illegal, but because the banking pipes have just been entirely sealed off.
Which creates a really dangerous paradox. Mm-hmm. Out of sheer necessity, those legitimate businesses and families sending remittances, they are pushed into less transparent, riskier, informal channels just to keep things moving.
Just to survive.
Yeah. So stripped regulatory lists can actually inadvertently increase financial crime risk by driving the legitimate economy underground.
Getting off these lists is clearly vital to a country's economic survival, then. Our sources note Pakistan completed 34 reform items across two action plans. The 2018 plan focused heavily on counter-terrorist financing, like improving supervision and dismantling the logistics networks of UN-designated groups.
That was the first major hurdle.
Right. But then the 2021 action plan tackled broader anti-money laundering weaknesses. Specifically, Pakistan had to regulate what the industry calls DNFBPs.
Designated non-financial businesses and professions.
Right, which sounds like a mouthful, but we are talking about real estate agents, precious metal dealers, accountants. I mean, how do you even begin to impose compliance protocols on a local jeweler in a largely cash-based economy?
It is so hard. It requires a massive cultural and operational shift. You cannot just pass a law in the capital. You have to build an enforcement apparatus from scratch.
Right.
For a precious metals dealer, it means forcing them to officially register with a regulatory body. It means mandating that they perform customer due diligence if someone walks in with cash above a certain threshold, and actually requiring them to file suspicious transaction reports if a transaction doesn't make economic sense.
So if someone walks in with a duffel bag of cash to buy 50 gold chains, the jeweler actually has to ask for their ID and report the sale, rather than just taking the cash and looking the other way.
Exactly. And you have to send government inspectors out to these businesses to audit their records and impose fines if they fail to comply. It's a huge undertaking.
Yeah.
But by shutting those non-banking back doors, Pakistan made significant technical progress. By February 2022, they were assessed as being compliant or largely compliant with 38 of the 40 FATF recommendations.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though, because 38 out of 40 sounds like a stellar grade. But getting laws on the books creates a totally different problem on the ground, doesn't it?
Oh, for sure.
There is this massive canyon between technical compliance and real-world results. I mean, flawless paperwork doesn't prove that local authorities actually know how to intercept suspicious funds on the street.
And this raises a super important question about effectiveness. Technical compliance is merely the foundation. The FATF evaluates whether a country has the tools. The real test is whether the country utilizes those tools effectively to secure convictions and actually confiscate illicit assets.
Right, putting the laws to use.
Yeah, because even with these massive legislative reforms, Pakistan's risk environment remains highly material.
Which brings us to the lingering shadows. Our sources, specifically Pakistan's own 2023 National Risk Assessment, they don't shy away from this at all.
No, they are quite transparent about it.
Yeah, they highlight that corruption, bribery, tax crime, and cash smuggling remain among the country's highest money laundering threats. Cash is still incredibly central to the economy there, and the country sits right across major global trade and migration corridors.
Which is a perfect storm for risk.
Absolutely. The assessment also specifically flags illegal money and value transfer services, naming hawala and hundi. Now, compliance teams historically freak out when they see the word hawala, treating it as an automatic red flag for terror financing. But that's a massive misunderstanding of how these value transfer systems actually function, isn't it?
It is a profound misunderstanding. Hawala and hundi are not synonymous with terrorism or money laundering. Not at all. They are highly efficient, informal value transfer systems built on centuries of trust and personal networks, long predating modern banking.
Walk us through the actual mechanics of a lawful hawala transfer. How does it work?
Okay, so if a worker in Dubai wants to send money to their family in a remote Pakistani village, a place without a bank branch, they give their cash to a hawaladar in Dubai.
Like a local broker.
Right. That broker contacts their counterpart in the village, who immediately hands the equivalent local currency out of their own reserves directly to the family.
Wait, so no money actually crosses a border in that moment?
Zero. No money crosses. The two brokers just settle their debt later, often through complex trade invoices. It is rapid, it's highly accessible, and it is incredibly cheap for the worker.
I mean, it sounds like an absolute lifeline for the unbanked. The risk, I assume, isn't the system itself, but the visibility.
Exactly. The risk materializes when these providers operate outside the licensed regulatory framework. When they do not perform customer due diligence, when they don't keep formal records or report to authorities, the paper trail just vanishes.
And the bad guys take advantage of that.
Yeah, sophisticated criminal networks can use that exact same efficient, trust-based system to move illicit funds entirely under the radar of law enforcement.
That lack of visibility also really plagues international trade, right? The sources flag trade-based money laundering, or TBML, as a major priority.
Mm-hmm.
I think people generally understand how someone launders a duffel bag of cash, but laundering money through international shipping containers seems exponentially harder to catch.
Mm-hmm.
How does invoice manipulation actually move money?
What's fascinating here is how criminals exploit the disconnect between the financial paperwork and the physical goods themselves.
Okay.
Say a criminal organization in Europe owes $1 million of illicit profits to an affiliate in Pakistan. Instead of wiring the money, which would obviously trigger bank alerts, the European entity buys $1 million worth of cheap plastic buckets.
Wait, just regular plastic buckets?
Yeah, literally basic plastic buckets. They ship the buckets to Pakistan. But on the customs documentation and the commercial invoice that they present to the bank, they describe the cargo as highly specialized medical equipment worth $2 million.
Oh, wow.
And then the Pakistani affiliate pays the $2 million to the European entity for this quote-unquote medical equipment.
So by over-invoicing the cheap buckets, the Pakistani affiliate just successfully transferred $1 million of extra value back to Europe, fully disguised as a routine international trade payment.
Exactly. And they can do the reverse with under-invoicing too, or even use phantom shipments where goods are paid for but never actually leave the port.
The friction there for a bank compliance officer must be astronomical.
Mm.
because the bank only sees the letter of credit and the invoice, right? They aren't at the port opening the shipping container to check if it's medical gear or plastic buckets.
They absolutely are not. The bank has to rely entirely on documentary consistency. They have to scrutinize the shipping routes, the pricing norms, and the historical behavior of the trading entities.
That sounds incredibly tedious.
It is. And if trade-based money laundering is complex because it hides illicit value in vast quantities of legitimate commerce, well, terrorist financing is an entirely different analytical challenge because of the scale.
We were talking about microtransactions here, right?
Often tiny amounts of money. With money laundering, you know, you are taking dirty money and trying to clean it.
Right.
Terrorist financing often reverses that flow. You take entirely clean, money lawful income, legitimate charity donations, routine commercial profits, and you divert it to a dirty purpose. It is a needle in a haystack where the needle looks exactly like a piece of hay until the moment it is actually used to fund an attack.
So we are left with a country that has successfully rewritten its laws, regulated its jewelers and real estate agents, and convinced the EU and FATF to remove their high-risk labels. Yet it is still battling deeply entrenched cash smuggling, unlicensed hawala networks, complex trade manipulation, and terrorist financing.
It's a lot to manage.
If you are a global financial institution today, how do you even operationalize this? I mean, you can't rely on the lazy blanket ban anymore, but you also obviously can't blindly trust every transaction.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, banks basically have to build what the industry calls a resilient control stack.
A resilient control stack.
Yeah, it is an architecture of integrated defense layers that allows an institution to pinpoint actual risk without grinding legitimate commerce to a halt.
Let's examine how a bank actually builds that stack. It has to start with list governance, right?
Yeah.
Like knowing exactly what regulatory lists have changed.
That is layer one. Accurate list governance requires dynamic data feeds. A bank cannot just have a generic bad country flag hard-coded into their system anymore.
Right, because things change.
Exactly. They need to know exactly which list changed, under what legal authority, and what specific enhanced measures were removed. If a legacy IT system fails to update, well, the bank might continue applying illegal friction to customers. Or conversely, they might drop controls they are legally required to maintain for other sanctions regimes.
Okay, so once the system knows the legal baseline, it obviously has to know who it's actually doing business with. Which brings us to beneficial ownership transparency. Essentially, finding the actual puppet master instead of just interrogating the puppet.
Layer two is critical. Criminals use nominees, legal arrangements, and layered shell companies to obscure their involvement. Institutions must have protocols in place to pierce those corporate veils and identify the ultimate human beings controlling the funds, and crucially, corroborate how they actually generated their wealth.
And once you know who the customer is, you have to monitor their behavior. But a generic algorithm looking at every customer in the exact same way is just going to generate useless noise.
Which is exactly why layer three is sector-sensitive monitoring. You tune the transaction monitoring algorithms based on the customer's specific industry.
Okay, give me an example of that.
Well, you do not monitor a highly regulated, publicly traded export business the exact same way you monitor a small, cash-intensive charity operating near a volatile border region.
Right, that makes total sense.
They require completely different risk indicators and thresholds.
But legacy banks are notorious for having terrible silo databases, aren't they? I mean, the credit card division doesn't talk to the mortgage division, and the trade finance database is running on a server from, like, 1998. How do they actually spot organized crime rings if their data is that fragmented?
That is the friction point of layer four, which is network analysis. Moving beyond basic relational databases to graph technology.
Graph technology.
Yeah, because individual account reviews will always miss the bigger picture. Network analysis connects seemingly disparate data points across the entire institution. Right, like do five different, seemingly unrelated corporate accounts all log in from the exact same obscure IP address? Do they share a phone number or maybe a junior company director? Uncovering those hidden connections reveals illicit networks that a siloed review process could never detect.
But that level of scrutiny inevitably generates false alarms.
Right.
Which means you need some kind of feedback loop.
Layer 5 is outcome testing, because compliance teams suffer from massive alert fatigue. You have to constantly analyze the system's output. Are tuned rules actually catching real financial crime and generating useful suspicious transaction reports for law enforcement? Or are they just flagging thousands of routine legitimate payments that analysts then have to manually close out day after day? The control stack must be continuously tested and refined.
It sounds incredibly resource intensive, but it seems like it's the only way to facilitate global trade safely. So what does this all mean? If we zoom out from the specific layers of compliance technology, the journey of Pakistan's delisting is a massive regulatory achievement. It removes a heavy mandatory friction that was basically strangling legitimate commerce and driving money underground.
It is a huge step forward, absolutely.
But the ultimate lesson here, whether you are a compliance officer tuning an algorithm or just a regular person navigating the complexities of the modern world, is that lists and labels are just signals. They are not substitutes for actual critical analysis.
Right. The removal of a label should never produce automatic trust, just as the application of a label should not produce automatic exclusion. Evidence has to drive the decision-making process.
Which leaves me with a final thought I really want you, the listener, to mull over. Our sources briefly warned against something called silent downgrades, and that's when a company or a bank quietly drops their security controls after a delisting, not because the risk is actually gone, but just to save time and money, hiding behind the fact that the legal mandate just vanished. It made me think about how we all process risk in our daily lives. In our hyper-connected world, when an official red flag is finally lowered, whether it's a country's risk rating, a safety warning on a product you buy, or even just a bad reputation someone had, how much of your new trust is actually based on hard evidence? And how much of it is just the sheer relief of not having to look so closely anymore? Mm-hmm. Like getting off that do not fly list, are we letting the relief of technical compliance blind us to the messy reality of real human behavior?
That is a brilliant way to frame it.
Thank you for joining us for this deep dive. Keep questioning the labels, and we'll catch you next time.